And so with that as an introduction, we'll call our Brother Dan to come back up for his third class, His Long War. Brother Dan.
And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, that last one was the short one? Hopefully we can get through this relatively efficiently, but also I hope I can carry you with me and we can feel the excitement. I know three sessions of me is a lot. My apologies for that. I should have warned your committee. So thank you for bearing with this. The other thing I wanted to mention just before we jump in is hopefully this little chart is helping, because I appreciate at times there's just so many quotes coming at you, so many passages, to be able to sort of pull back a little bit and go, hold up, where are we? What are we doing? We're here. So hopefully the way the slides are keyed in and the fact that there's a little icon on every single one of them to help you find out kind of where we are is proving useful to you as we go. So, how are we going? Starting to see a bit more, get a bit more colour in our pictures, I hope. Hopefully we're starting to see a bit of an image forming too. We can see that vast metal soldier astride the globe. And maybe we can see a stone, a river rounded stone, like a shepherd's pebble. Small at first, but then it grows as all things do as they approach us, and it tumbles, it's tumbling and it's falling and it's smashing into those fragile terracotta feet of the image. And then it's growing, isn't it? It's growing as it grinds this broken idol. It's growing, and there's a mountain's peak thrusting upwards and upwards into the sky. Hopefully we're all finding material in our study with which to build our vision, to clothe your future with reality. Because as Seneca, the famous Stoic philosopher, said, to the person who does not know where he wants to go, there is no favorable wind. We have to be able to see over the horizon of our noisy now to the future that God has set in store. And to set our course that way, to go, I can see over that horizon now. Right now I can see it. I will set my course by that. Or as someone else once said, we go where our vision is. If our vision is to lose 5 kilos, to have a nice house, and to pay off the car, that's how far we'll go. But if your vision is Zion, and a place of glory in the kingdom of God, well, we can set our sights on that and set our course accordingly. So 15 minutes ago, we finished off that period of time in which there was the building madness that led to Armageddon. And while we named a few of the key protagonists, it's important to remind ourselves that all nations will be represented there. Every nation in some capacity will be involved in this Armageddon, this conflict in the Middle East. And as a consequence, every nation will witness the arrival of the great king and his saints. Perhaps they'll be there as part of a UN delegation. Perhaps they'll be as allies in a polarized world. But in the end, all nations will know that our God, he is Yahweh, as Elijah told a torn nation. And even the billions who do not march into this theater of conflict under one of the banners of the kingdom of men, even all those people who stayed at home safe and sound, they too will know unquestionably that something awe-inspiring has just occurred. Isaiah 2 says this, "For the day of Yahweh of armies shall be upon everyone that is proud and lofty, upon everyone that is lifted up, and he shall be brought low, and they shall go into the holes of the rocks and the caves of the earth for the fear of Yahweh and for the glory of his majesty." And here's the phrase I want you to note. When he arises to shake terribly the earth, from Argentina to Iceland, all will know. Zechariah chapter 14, verse 4 and 5, we're a little bit earlier, described the moment that the angel of Yahweh's feet touched the Mount of Olives. Describes that rending, tearing convulsion that contorts the earth. And it describes how as the earth reels, Zechariah's Lord and Zechariah and all the saints arrive. Can you see how it says that? And his, the Yahweh angel's feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives will cleave in the midst thereof towards the east and the west, and there shall be a very great valley. Half the mountain will remove towards the north, half towards the south. You, Jewish people, will flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach unto Azel. Ye shall flee like ye fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And Yahweh, says Zechariah, Yahweh, my God, shall come, and all the saints with you, O Yahweh, my God. What a wonderful moment. Zechariah arrives and he visualizes, he can see himself marching through the gap left where the mountain has been torn in half with Yahweh, his God, Jesus, the Christ, the King. We said in our last session we were going to spend just a little time on the earthquake, even though technically it occurs before the saints enter the fray in the mountains around Jerusalem. And we just want to add a little bit more detail so we've sort of got a rounded picture of how that critical moment works. Most of us will be aware that the lowest point on the earth's surface is the Jordan Valley, and that this low point marks the path of one of the most significant fault lines of the many that circle our shattered globe. Running north to south, the Dead Sea Transform System, or the Dead Sea Rift as it is sometimes called, is a series of faults that run from the vast fault junction up in Turkey down towards Africa. And as a consequence of the vast stresses that are exerted by the African plate in the west, the Arabian plate in the east, and the Eurasian plates in the north, it is here that the strain of these titanic vessels afloat the turbulent seas of magma beneath is loaded. Right there in the Dead Sea Rift. And running east to west from this schism, perpendicular to the chasm of the Dead Sea, is the Mount of Olives fault. And Zechariah tells us that this earthquake will cleave the mount along a line east-west before pushing the two halves apart, northwards and southwards. This great earthquake tears olives in half and creates a great, sorry, I'm just showing you a little bit more detail there. Yes, animations, neat. This great earthquake creates a vast valley. Here's what Isaiah says. For Tophet is ordained of old. In other words, the valley of Tophet has had a purpose mapped out of it and for it, from time immemorial. For the King it is prepared. He hath made it deep and large, the pile thereof is fire and much wood, the breath of Yahweh like the stream of brimstone doth kindle it. So here is a description of this vast, wide, open volcanic valley. There are going to be some huge changes to the land. The topography of the land of Israel will change entirely. Zechariah 14 verse 10 talks about the land being turned, which means actually flattened. The land will be flattened from Geba even to Rimmon. It's a vast area to flatten when you think about it. It's about 10 kilometers north of Jerusalem, all of the way down to 40 kilometers southwest. And the most mountainous part of the Judean hill country, now flat. Flat. Where right now, it is just these stepping, climbing mountains as you look up towards the north. It's hard to articulate or to comprehend the scale of the earthquake that God has prepared. And it's absolutely impossible to exaggerate it. I used to try and illustrate this earthquake to people using nuclear bombs for scale. But there was a problem with that, and that is, I was trying to use a sort of analogy to show you how big the earthquake is by using you another analogy that you haven't seen either. And very few people here have much first-hand experience dropping nuclear bombs, and so it kind of didn't make a lot of an impression. And so instead what I'm going to try and do is hopefully something better. We're going to use God's words, and I want to come to Isaiah 24, please. Isaiah 24, and we're trying to get a picture in our minds of what this earthquake will be like. I've got a vivid memory of being at a young people's event, a youth conference in Australia, and they characterised this moment when the great earthquake had occurred, and one of these people, one of the characters just stuck in my mind. Because she was sobbing and she was crying for the death of her family and of her neighbors. And she said to the audience, "I never knew it would be like this." And it's stuck in my mind ever since, the thought that my neighbors might say, "I never knew. No one ever told me." Well, here we are, Isaiah 24. I want you to notice the context of what we're talking about in verse 23. Verse 23 says, "Then the moon shall be confounded, the sun shall be ashamed." When? "When Yahweh of armies shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and before his ancients," we can insert the missing phrase, "his ancient saints, gloriously." When is this? Well, this chapter finishes in the kingdom age, doesn't it? That's the context of our chapter. And so, verse 18, "It shall come to pass that he who flees from the noise of the fear shall fall into the pit, and he that comes up out of the midst of the pit shall be taken in a snare, for the windows from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth do shake. The earth is utterly broken down. The earth is clean dissolved. The earth is moved exceedingly. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard. It shall be removed like a cottage, and the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it. It shall fall, and it shall not rise again. And it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and the kings of the earth that are upon the earth." You see it? The earth breaketh, is what the Hebrew says. The earth crashes. The earth tottereth. And it uses the image of your backyard shed. You know, the one that's in the backyard and it's been affected by ants or by rain and it's weak, and then the wind comes along and it's swaying in the wind. And any second you know it's going to collapse, and then it comes. It collapses like that weakened shed and falls to the ground. What an amazing thing. Flick across to Isaiah 30 for a minute. We're very close there, just a few pages across. Verse 19 for context, just so we know that we're in the same point of time. He says, verse 19 of chapter 30, "For the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. They will weep no more. He will be very gracious unto thee at the voice of thy cry. When he shall hear it, he will answer thee. This is a time when the people are heard of God dwelling in Zion. That's the context. And here's what it says. Verse 25. There shall be upon every high mountain, upon every high hill, the strangest of things. Way up there, rivers and streams of water. Springs breaking out where springs ought not be. When in the day of the great slaughter, when the towers fall. Haggai says this, for thus says Yahweh of armies, yet once, it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens, and I will shake the earth, and the sea, and the land, and I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come. And after that, I'll fill this house with glory. Heavens, earth, sea, land. This is the first truly global earthquake in all of history. He said he would never again flood the earth with water. But this is close. Ezekiel 38. We know this passage, but we've read these words 1,000 times, but have you thought about what it says? In my jealousy, in the fire of my wrath have I spoken. Surely in that day there shall be a great shaking in the land of Israel, so that the fish and the birds feel it. What sort of an earthquake is so big that birds are going, what was that? Birds. How big? And why does God choose to use an earthquake? Why not use something else? What? Well, hail? Well, you can hide undercover for that, can't you? Doesn't matter how big the hail is, you can find a way to hide from it. Hurricane? There's shelter strong enough to resist a hurricane. Flood, move to high ground. Earthquake, who, show of hands, who here has been in an earthquake? Yeah? You know, don't you? I don't know what sort of earthquake you've been in, but some of these earthquakes, you feel them coming first. Before they hit, you feel them right here. It's kind of like a hearing with your chest. And then it comes. And you know that earthquake is coming, but there is nothing you can do to protect yourself. Nothing at all. You can't run. You can't hide. There is nowhere you can go. And so God will humble the pride of the kingdoms of men. Tanks, jets, aircraft carriers. He laughs these to scorn. I think this part is, it's less vision, isn't it? It's more nightmare, if anything. Millions, even billions, likely to perish in the seconds and the hours and the weeks that follow. But I find comfort when I think about this, that our Lord is never, ever indiscriminate. In another day of God's battle, in another day when God used an earthquake, in the day of Joshua, the earthquake destroyed the city in one blow, didn't it? And yet, we know the story, there was one section of wall that stood, almost like a finger pointing up towards the sky, testimony pointing at the very discriminate God as Rahab's family alone survived. And so it will be again. The redeemable will be redeemed. God is capable of using a global earthquake and still ensuring everybody who can be reached stays safe. And so Gog's image falls. And the next phase will begin. They fall upon the mountains of Israel. And now a vast effort to remove the ruins of war commences. Ezekiel chapter 39 verse 9 tells us that this particular task will occupy 7 years. 7 years. This I think gives us an idea of the size and scale of this conflict. There will be a dedicated team of weapons disposal experts who will spend 7 years burning weapons and burying bodies in mass graves on the east of the now reviving Dead Sea. 7 years. Gog will find his grave there on the far side of the Jordan. Who's going to do this? Who's going to manage this cleanup effort? Who's going to be these weapons disposal experts? What's those who dwell in Israel, we're told? Those that dwell in Israel will be given this particular task. In other words, those who are rescued from the barbaric tyranny of Gog's hatred. And you see, as the ground's shaking stopped, the Jews in Jerusalem will shake the brick dust out of their hair and they will look up to see the most amazing thing. Here it is, concealed for thousands of years in the Psalms. The message, the words that the Jews will say when they see Jesus Christ coming through that gap left behind by the Mount of Olives. They will say, "Who is this King of Glory?" They will hear a shout from outside, people shouting, "Lift up the gates, open the gates, let him in." Who is this King of Glory? They don't know who he is, but they can see he is glorious. The answer comes, it's the Lord, strong and mighty. The Lord who's just won this battle. Lift up the gates. This is a thing that the ancient walls of Jerusalem have waited thousands of years to witness. And so the Prince of Princes will come in. He will be acknowledged and witnessed by all of those who are in the land of Israel at the time. We know this passage. Then they will mourn for him. They will witness the one whom they pierced. They will see the holes in his hands and they will know. He will be mourned by his people. And while this is happening, the dust is settling worldwide. Can you imagine? All around the world, everyone's scrambling to try and, we haven't got a prime minister anymore. We're going to have to find another one. Where is he? Under that rock. It's a bit of a grotesque thought, isn't it? But the world will be scrambling to find ways to put itself together, cut off from other nations, not quite sure what's happening. Communications down. And gradually the world will pick itself up, shake out the dust. And the dust will settle. And there's this brief period of global quiet as the shaken rulers of the world struggle to work out just what had happened, what to do next. And they all try to dig themselves out. Well, the world is not going to be left to ponder this question for very long. Not for very long at all. Come across to Isaiah 66, please. Isaiah 66, we'll go to verse 15 and 16. And again, it's useful for us to sort of keep on making sure we know what our context is. So Isaiah 66 and verse 16 says this, "For by fire..." So we'll start in verse 15. "For behold, Yahweh will come with fire, with chariots like a whirlwind, to render his anger with fury, his rebuke with flames. By fire and by sword will the Lord plead with all humanity, all flesh. And the slain of Yahweh shall be many." This is a description of the events of Armageddon. And the verses that will follow are just after those verses about Armageddon. Armageddon has just been completed, and we read in verse 19, "And I will set a sign among them, and I will send those that escape of them unto the nations, to Tarshish, to Pul, to Lud, to those that draw the bow, to Tubal, to Jabin, to the isles afar off, that have not heard my fame, neither have seen my glory. And they shall declare my glory amongst the Gentiles, and they shall bring your brethren for an offering unto Yahweh out of all nations, upon horses, upon chariots, and litters, upon mules, upon swift beasts, to my holy mountain Jerusalem, says Yahweh, as the children of Israel bring an offering in the clean vessel into the house of Yahweh." So what's happening here? Well, the great king will send messengers out to the world's nations, the ambassadors of the state of Zion, who will set a sign amongst every nation to which they go. A wonder, we're told. And that wonder is that they will declare the wonder of a victorious Savior. And here's the wonderful bit. Who is a 2,000-year-old man. A 2,000-year-old Messiah, the Son of the Living God. Now that's a wonder. Can you imagine trying to explain that to the government today? And so these ambassadors will come out to declare him. And who are these ambassadors? Who's he sending? What's those that escaped? Jews who were in the land at the time of Armageddon, who've been rescued from the terrible individual and national fate of Armageddon. Those are they who were sent out to do what they were always meant to do in the first place. Jews were meant to be a witness to the existence of a terrible and wonderful God. That's the passage that comes up again and again with the children of Israel, that they may know that I am Yahweh. And now the world will know that he is Yahweh, as Jews come to declare what's being done in Zion and who it was who has won that victory. And they will demand a very particular gift, a tribute from nations, a specific mark of submission, the return of their brethren. They will demand that the nations send back the Jews that are within their borders. Some nations, well, they will send their governments back with the ambassadors, that they themselves might witness for themselves the reality of Christ and his saints. Verse 18 says, "For I know their works and their thoughts," speaking of the nations, "it shall come that I will gather," post-Armageddon, "all nations and tongues that will come and see my glory." So some will come, they will witness, they'll see. But others will stay away. And the ambassadors come out to them and tell them what they must do, and they ignore that call. And so the commanders come out. The first message from Jesus Christ has gone out to the world. An appeal has been made in the terms of Revelation chapter 14. The mid-heaven gospel has been proclaimed. It's called the mid-heaven gospel because the great king and the saints now occupy the upper heavens politically. And that has pushed the rulers of this world down into, well, they were previously at the apex of the power structure, if you like. Now they've been pushed down. They're now in the middle of heaven. And for a gospel, they are told great news. They are told that their nations will flourish in the kingdom if they submit to the reign of Jesus Christ, the monarch of the new world. It's great news. The government in, where is it, Ottawa? Yeah, is told, submit to Christ and your nation will flourish. This is great news for you. And the best way you can honor the votes that your people have entrusted you with. And then, with this message delivered, breathing time is granted to our world. Our king will pause. He is secure in Zion, his dwelling place, and he will await the world's response. Isaiah 18 verse 3 and 4 describes this period. All ye inhabitants of the world and dwellers of the earth, see ye, when he lifteth up the ensign on the mountains and when he bloweth the trumpet, hear ye. For Yahweh says unto me, I will take my rest and I will consider in my dwelling place like a clear heat upon the herbs. Now, what's being described in these verses is this period of Christ's confidence. He already knows which nations will submit and which will resist, and so he waits. He's allowing, if you like, pressure to build. And I want to read you a paragraph from Brother Thomas because I love the way he catches the tone of this period of waiting, of what's described here as the heat upon the herbs. It's this heavy summer heat. You know how you have those days where it's just humid and hot and still before the storm. Here's what Brother Thomas, that's not what Brother Thomas says. Let's see. I haven't got it here, but he describes it as a heavy building heat before the storm. He says this, during the stillness of this awful phase, not a gleam of sunshine for a moment penetrates the impending gloom. Not a breath stirs, not a leaf wags, not a blade of grass is shaken. No rippling wave curls upon the sleeping surface of the waters. The black ponderous cloud covering the whole sky seems to hang fixed and motionless as an arch of stone. Nature itself seems benumbed in all its operations. Such is the condition of the torpid atmosphere before the bursting forth of a raging tempest. When instead of fearing God and giving glory to him, they assemble themselves together to give battle against God's king. So here's is Brother Thomas, and he's describing this period of a building storm as the nations conspire against Christ and before Christ, who knows about their conspiracy, responds. And so in this period, even though there is this calm surface, this calm exterior, the rulers of our globe, the presidents and the generals, the billionaires and the thought leaders, the heads of faith, oh, they're busy. On the surface, they look, oh, so serene, and underneath, they're paddling like crazy. Come across to Psalm chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. Psalm chapter 2. Why do the heathen rage? Why do the people imagine a vain thing, an empty thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against Yahweh and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. The kings of the world are conspiring. They're already bound as they are constrained by his command, and yet they conspire to resist against God and against this anointed. Verse 6 says, "Yet I have set my king, Jesus Christ, upon my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree, says the king. Yahweh has said unto me, you are my son, this day have I begotten you. And so Jesus Christ is there, he's established in Mount Zion, and yet even still, with him in power, the nations are conspiring. The kings are taking counsel together to break off the shackles, as they see it, of Jesus Christ. And you say, well, which nations? Who will conspire? Revelation chapter 19, verse 19 is set in this period, the period of after Armageddon, and it describes the king's adversaries as the beast and the kings of the earth and the false prophet. The beast, the kings of the earth, and the false prophet. Now, we know who they represent. These represent respectively Western and Central Europe, the heart of the Catholic dominion, motivated by the false prophet, the Pope of our age. Revelation chapter 17 uses slightly different symbols to indicate exactly the same picture, the same alliance. It describes the 10 kings, the 10 European kings, allied with the beast and ridden by the mother of harlots. And so the war that is about to begin after Armageddon is going to be a long and terrible war. A war of deliberate resistance against God, against and against his son. Revelation chapter 14, verse 19 and 20 describes this war as the winepress out of which blood flows. Such an evocative image. This wine press being stamped down and crushed, and blood is flowing out of the wine press. Where Armageddon is described as a threshing, as a stone grinding to powder, and the residue being blown away like the summer trough, like it says in Daniel chapter 2 and Isaiah chapter 17. This war, the war that follows Armageddon, is much more deliberate. It's more personal for both sides. The language of a wine press for this long war is very expressive and very gory. Gory but expressive. And it's got coded into it some really interesting clues around the timing of the war. You see, in Israel in Bible times and even today, the grape harvest and the pressing that followed right after that harvest followed the harvest of the wheat and its threshing. But they occupy very different durations of time. So you, in the year, you first of all have the harvest of the wheat and the threshing of the wheat, followed by the harvest of the grape and the pressing of the grape. But they occupy different periods of the time. The wheat would be harvested in a single month during the month of Ziv. And the cut sheaves would be left in the field to dry before all being threshed and winnowed at the end. On the other hand, the grape harvest would begin in the following month, but would extend for 4 months. But there was this ongoing cycle throughout those 4 months of picking and pressing and picking and pressing and picking and pressing, with the pressing being almost continuous until the harvest was complete. I want you to notice the ratio here. It's a ratio of 1 to 4. And it closely matches, if you note, our suggested timeline. Hopefully you'll be able to see what I'm trying to do here. It's quite remarkable how this matches up quite neatly with the timeline we're suggesting of about 50 years from the return of Christ to the opening of the temple, and about, give or take, 10 years occupied from the return of Christ to the completion of judgment and of Armageddon. And in fact, Revelation chapter 14 verse 20 provides a measurement to describe this period and measures it at 1600 furlongs. And Brother Thomas argues for us that 1600 is the square of 40, a number used frequently in the Bible for times of testing and of judgment. And so this long war will be both. It will be a time of testing for some and a time of judgment for others. And so this symbol of 40 years or 40 as the period describing this period is very apt as a description for the time that will be engaged by Christ in prosecuting this judgment and this war. Now, there's a little bit of confusion out there because there are different terms used to describe Armageddon and the war that follows Armageddon. Malachi chapter 4 and Joel chapter 2 verse 31 describe this as the period that leads to the great and dreadful day of the Lord. That's not the same language that's used of Armageddon. So the language of Armageddon is the day of Yahweh. This is the great and terrible day. And we might ask, why does the great king, with all the power at his disposal, not just send another earthquake against these nations, or a volcano, or just blow them up somehow? Why not do it that way? In our terms, why doesn't he just go nuclear on them? And finish this war off fast. Why let it drag on for 40 long, terrible years? A bit like some of you are probably feeling like this talk has. And the answer is because they've got his people. His people, Abraham's seed, live in the countries he's trying to defeat. And they haven't let them go. They refuse to let them go. And so this long, agonizing war of attrition, at least for one side, grinds on, with the Jews serving as hostages and human shields held by the beast and by the 10 kings, all led by the mother of harlots, by Jezebel, the chaste one. Sorry, here's the Malachi quote in case you wanted it, by the way. And so there's something really beautiful about a king's choice of who he then sends out to manage this appeal to the nations to gift the king with the global diaspora. And then the same person is given the task, when that appeal fails, at least in those countries where the churches grow the tallest, to lead the expeditionary force that will fight their way into these nations and help the hostage Jews fight their way out. One man has been selected of old by God to do this. A man who has first-hand experience of fighting Jezebel. A man who already loves using weather as a weapon. A man who has experience calling fire from heaven and slaying false prophets. A man who met with Christ at the Transfiguration with Moses to discuss the subject of exoduses, and yet at that point had never been involved in one. Israel were promised, weren't they, that Elijah would come before the great and terrible day. Here it is, Malachi 4 verse 5. And it is he who will both fight this war and rescue Abraham's seed from the ends of the earth. A project that, like Moses' mission, will take 40 years. 40 years that will result in a devastated Europe, wasted by new plagues, perhaps enough plagues for each king to have one. 40 years that will result in a purged and purified Jewish people ready to enter the land of God ready to enter the land of promise that Abraham has yearned for forever. Now, if you quickly read over Malachi 4, it's not hard to conclude that Elijah is to be sent before Armageddon and not some other time. But when you look closer at the passages that refer to Elijah's work, a pattern begins to emerge that helps us understand that Elijah's work starts after Armageddon. Joel chapter 2 speaks of the same great and terrible day as Malachi speaks of, but Joel chapter 2 verse 28 to 31 that speaks of this great and terrible day occurs after the events of Joel chapter 2 verse 20, when a great and terrible northern invader is destroyed. Isaiah chapter 11 verse 12 describes the rescue of the king's people, which happens after the king has captured Zion. Isaiah chapter 43 verse 5 and 6, a chapter that begins with the word but, that connects it to the previous chapter, talks about how he will bring back his seed from the four corners of the earth, which follows the events in chapter 42, where God goes forth in his fury to fight against the nations at Armageddon. Zephaniah chapter 3 does the same thing. Afterwards, there's a rescue of the Jewish people from as far away as Ethiopia. But before that in the chapter, we have the events where God's indignation are poured out in Armageddon. And Malachi chapter 4 is no different. It begins with the first verse that talks about a day of judgment where the wicked are like a product of the wheat harvest. And then finally in verse 5 of Malachi chapter 4, Elijah comes before the day that follows Armageddon. We'll come back to that verse in a minute. So hopefully what you're starting to see in this, in the sort of series of quotes that are presented here discussing this period, it addresses one of the most discussed prophetic subjects, which is when does Elijah come? Does he come during Armageddon, before Armageddon? When does he come? And hopefully what you're seeing in the sort of repetition of passages there is that every time he comes after the war of Armageddon. And Elijah's mission is not just a functional one. It's not just a mission to communicate with a shattered world and to recover scattered Jewry. Most of all, what he's coming to do is it's a spiritual mission. His mission is about hearts. It's about conversion and it's about change. And yes, as part of that, he needs to fight the nations of Europe to rescue Jewry. But that's merely dealing with a symptom of the problem. The real thing he's trying to achieve is the turning of hearts. Luke chapter 1 interprets this particular passage for us. And the angel here repurposes Malachi's prophecy to explain John's work to his father Zacharias. And in so doing, the angel gave us insight into Malachi's words. And he tells us that Elijah's work will be to turn children's hearts towards their God, so that their hearts become like Abraham's and Isaac's and Jacob's. The work of Elijah will to prepare a nation ready for their king. That's what we're being told by the angel here. And so, just as Moses had to both rescue a trapped people and convert a faithless nation, so Elijah will have to do the same. The long war, coupled with a nation's spiritual rescue, these two, they're intertwined. I want you to come to Ezekiel chapter 20. Ezekiel chapter 20, which was, of course, our reading, because that chapter illustrates this point, and we wouldn't have read it if we didn't want it to refer to it. So Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 33. And I sense that you, like me, are flagging. So I'll try and wind things up as quickly as I can. Ezekiel 20, verse 33. He says, "As I live, saith Yahweh God, saith the Lord God, surely with a mighty hand, with a stretched out arm, with fury poured out, will I rule over you, and I will bring you out from the people, and will gather you out of the countries wherein you are scattered, with a mighty hand, with a stretched out arm, and with fury poured out." So God here wishes to bring his people out. Verse 35, "I will bring you into the wilderness, away from the people, and there will I plead with you face to face." God is going to bring his people into a wilderness again, and yet this act of bringing them into the wilderness requires a mighty hand and fury poured out as Elijah and his assistants fight alongside rescued flocks of Jews to fight their way out from amongst the people. This is an inverted war. It's fought from the inside out. As in many nations, the pattern that was established by Pharaoh long ago is repeated. There will be a refusal to let Elijah's people go. An intensifying campaign of oppression. The cruelty and the hate will escalate. Nations will double down as they impact strive to create impact upon these people within their borders. And this persecution of the people within their borders will begin as it so often does. The nations of Europe will start with trivial sanctions and rules, and the diaspora, the Jews within their borders, will be unconvinced about the severity of what's going on. They're not quite sure they really want to leave and go back to Israel. After all, you know, they're just dealing with the earthquake here. They're probably dealing with it there as well. But new daily discriminatory laws will be added. There'll be the rise of hate crime, the blind eyes of law enforcement, media against them, propaganda, riots, lynchings. Here's what Jeremiah says about this period for the Jewish people. "Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble. But in the end, he'll be saved from it." See, Elijah's sent before the great and terrible day. He will be saved from it. When all the kingdoms of men threaten God's people and challenges God's command, Elijah will be there to rescue them. Isaiah 27 says this, "It shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come, which were ready to perish." The escapees who flee from these nations are described as being ready to perish. Isaiah 49 describes them as prisoners in darkness. Jeremiah chapter 50 describes them as being oppressed together. The nations refuse to let them go. And the anger of the nations at this point in time is so dark, is so hateful, that not only do they refuse to release the Jews that are within their borders, that is natural Israel as it's described in these passages, but the Jewish messengers who have been sent by Christ to them are captured as well. But Elijah will bring them out with a mighty hand and outpoured fury to a wilderness away from those people. Verse 35 of the chapter open on our laps. "I will bring you into a wilderness," as it should be, "away from the people. And there will I plead with you, my people, face to face, like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt, so will I plead with you, saith the Lord God." And Elijah will begin the process of conversion, the work of the still, small voice. The wind, the earthquake, the fire are done. Now the voice. And out in the wilderness, Elijah will speak to them. He will speak to their hearts in the wilderness. Out in these places, there will be places of solitude. There will be several. It won't just be one. Elijah and the saints will work with Jury. And finally, after time, out in these quiet places, under the guidance of Elijah, their hearts will change. And it will be a very different nation that emerges from this time of rest, of restoration and of conversion out in the wilderness. Can you imagine this? Can you imagine being part of this? The years of quiet education to a people who, when they arrived, were either godless or law-locked. The miracles that will be required for us to perform to feed this nation. It'll be some 5 million people if only a third survive. There'll be manna and quail and streams of water from the rock once again as we feed them and we lead them as they walk from the ends of the world. And it will be our work to explain the wonder of our King to a people stiff-necked and stubborn. There will be groups coming from all corners of the globe, and we need to lead them and feed them and protect them. We, the saints, as our flocks merge one with another, growing, groups coming together into a vast pool of people waiting to enter the land. And while some of us here are involved in this quieter, gentler, more profitable work, there will be others still involved in the fury and clamor of war, a war of attrition to finally and irrevocably change the world, a war to make the mountain that grows from a stone that builders would reject, to make it fill the whole earth. And some of us will do this. And so the plagues will fall upon the beast and upon the 10 kings and upon the great Jezebel. And they will reduce Babylon the Great from the world's most enduring and powerful organization to a dark and poverty-filled shell, broken, isolated, and hated. And then one day, almost 50 years after that moment of the knock on the door, the hand on your shoulder, the front door left open and the aircon still on. 50 years on. And perhaps some of us here will witness this moment. Perhaps we'll be there to see as Elijah, the prophet of fire, but now a practitioner of the still, small voice. Perhaps we'll see as he stands right where the Tiber enters the sea and lifts a rock like a millstone and casts it into the sea, as behind him, with a great grinding crash, the caldera under Rome opens up and swallows Babylon the Great. Perhaps. Or perhaps not. But this thing will happen. Days or weeks later, a prophet will lead a saved and changed nation across the Jordan. And as they cross the plain towards the slope above which towers Mount Zion, they will pass through the Valley of Achor. And we're told that the Valley of Achor, the valley in which Achan died, will become a door of hope. And to me, nothing could make that valley more hopeful than if Achan himself were there to welcome the people into the land at the very place where he lost his first chance. Can you see it? May your winds always be favorable.